I guess it was first announced that I would talk about my life in the monkey house. And I talked to Doris after this was announced, Doris Edmonds, who has a simultaneous presentation now. And she says, you know, I've never heard you talk about your life in the monkey house, and I'm going to miss it. So I felt very badly. So I went back and I looked over the audience last night, and fortunately for me, most of you didn't know me. So I thought I'd give you the short course on listening. During our time together here, I hope that I will get to know most of you better. If you have children, I'm sure I'll get to know them better because I'm a bird watcher. You can tell that by my shirt. And I'll be kicking the children out for bird watches periodically, probably starting on Saturday. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad I'm here. I've lost count of how many times I've been here, but it's in the 30s. And I hope you'll make it up here that many times too. And every experience is a new one. And I guess I've heard Carol Hinderly on Bible study many, many times, but everyone is new. And if any of you missed his session this morning, be sure you make the next two, because you'll be hearing probably the outstanding Bible lesson teacher of probably anywhere, at least the greatest one I've ever heard. And you heard him this morning because I insisted that he be on here, because this starts my sessions at Holden right. You can't beat the combination of a wake up with Rich, and then Carol and Bible study, and I'm launched, and then I'll go fishing with Ruby. See? And so this is sort of anti-climax for this morning. I hope that those of you who are new here will really appreciate the beauty of the place. I've never seen it look better with all these flowers and all. And it's really great, and thanks to those who made this possible. I feel that I am qualified to discuss the subject of listening because I've been married for 33 years and 2 months and 1 day. The lament of every husband, every wife, every parent, every child, every pastor, every student, or parishioner rather, whether in confirmation class or in parishioner, but the lament of each one of these at some time or another is that you have ears, but you do not hear. And when you examine the communication area, you realize that probably 98% of what you and I learn, we learn through our eyes and our ears. And it is interesting for me then to examine this, to see, well, how much of each do we do or not do, and how good are we at it? As a scientist and as an educator, I'm interested in this. And I have been interested in it for a couple of decades. And my presentation today will be the amalgamation of what I have learned about this in several decades. And I go to the literature to study, for example, what Rankin observed in Ohio when he obtained the cooperation of quite a large number of workers. Mainly in a white-collar kind of a situation, but I guess there were some others. He obtained their cooperation for a period of about 2 months. The cooperation consisted of them recording how they spent their day, especially related to communication and other things. When I was with General Electric Company, We also did this. We kept track of our time for maybe a week at a time to find out how we wasted our time and how we what we did with our time for General Electric. And it was a very useful exercise. Well, in the case of Rankin, he was interested particularly in communication. And he found out that about, for these people, about 70% of their time was spent in communication. And the breakdown went something like this among the communication skills. There was about 9% of their time was spent in writing, about 15% in reading, 25 to 30% in speaking, and 45% in listening. Yet as you and I examine this, you realize that much of your academic life, in my case, it spans quite a number of years, and I know in your case it does, was spent in learning how to read in school and outside of school and trying to improve it. And a great amount of time was also spent in learning how to write. Now they're giving courses, which they didn't give when I was going to school, as much in how to speak. But hardly anything in listening. In fact, in a survey made by Nichols in Minnesota in the early 50s, he made a survey of all the universities and colleges to find out, was anybody teaching anything about comprehensive listening? And he found out there was only one college. I think it was, I can't even remember the name of it now. It's in the Midwest, and it was Stevens College. It was a girls' school, and it was taught as one of the social graces. I know some of them, and they did very well. But and we don't have to go far to get very bad examples or good examples of bad listening. And here I think it was a Bowman joke that really applies here. Some of you know Walt Bowman, and I hope he hasn't told you this story lately. But it's a modification of one of his. The neighbors had several children. The youngest one was a girl. Her name was Janet. And Janet was a very beautiful girl, inside and out. And her folks had protected her. And she was now a senior in high school, and she was choosing her college or school. Well, she realized that she wanted to get away from home, just like our daughters did. I put a limit on 1,000 miles on them. And I think they went 995, but in the case of Janet, they didn't put a limit on it. And so she picked a school 2,500 miles over, 3,000 miles away from home. And her folks were sort of wondering about this, but it was a denominational school of their denomination. So they went along with it. And Ms. Wood was very concerned about this. And because Janet had a pretty tight string attached, and it was going to be cut. So it came September, time for her to leave. And Miss Wood found herself alone in the kitchen with Janet. And she says, "Now, Janet, you're going away from home, and you're going to meet a lot of boys. And some of these boys will ask you to go out with them. And you will, and that's as it should be. And as the year probably goes along, you will probably become very attached to one of them, and it will concentrate on one person. And then some night, some evening after a college function, this boy will take you out in his car to some secluded spot. And he will turn off the lights and the motor, and then he will put his arm around you, and then your mother will start to worry." And with that, she closed the conversation, took her to the airport, and Janet was on her own. Well, Janet didn't come home for Thanksgiving because it was too far. But she came home at Christmas. And for those of you who have had children in college or have children in college or off away, you always look forward to these reunions. They're really great. And it was true at the Woods' residence, because Janet was coming home. Well, they had the usual happy reunion at the airport, and they came on home, and it wasn't long before Janet found herself again alone in the kitchen with her mother. And she says, she was asking her, mother was asking her how everything's going, and Janet was really bubbling. She says, "Well, you know, Mother, it's just like you said. You probably gleaned from my letters. I had a lot of dates, and then I settled sort of on Dave, and he's really great. And it was just the other night we had a function at the school, and then he asked me to go out with him in his car afterwards, and we went out to a secluded spot overlooking the town, and he turned off the lights and the motor, and then he started to put his arm around me, and so I remembered what you said, and I took his arm from around me, and I put my arm around him, and I said, 'Let your mother worry about you.'" I think that's an example of bad listening. I have many stories like that. We don't really, our comprehension of, in the listening area, and listening skill, is very deficient. And I'll give you a couple of examples of this. These are two studies, Jones at Columbia, and some of you who know Nichols' work probably from Minnesota, since half the village is usually from Minnesota. And what Jones did in his psychology class at Columbia was to try to have very good presentations for these 400 or so students. And then he developed an exam that was given right after the lecture to see what the students retained from what he thought they should have retained that was important. And he found out that the average retention of what he thought should have been retained after the lecture was about 50%. And then he waited 2 weeks, and he gave them the same exam, and then it was down to 25%. Now, you who are in business, you know you can't run a business this way. It's just impossible, and perhaps that is one reason why so many businesses fail. I could go into some studies that Nichols and others did in regard to this, as to the communication that do go on in businesses, where they'd send a student in to talk to management and find out how they felt that the communication was getting through to the people, and then turn him around and go then down to be a worker in those same plants, and then find out from the workers what they thought about what these managers, how the managers of the plant regarded it. And it was obvious that the communication really wasn't there. And it was really sad to read. And I do not have time to go into all of that today. But it's a sad commentary, but a true one, that there isn't really much communication. By the time when I was with General Electric Company, and by the time Ralph Cordner made a pronouncement in New York, and I was in management, but if I'd have been one step lower, I'd have been in the sheep pen looking out. But by the time it came to me, it had lost a lot. And there wasn't really much going up the other way, although he did visit us once. But if one is talking to a foreman on the line, two foremen on the line, then there is better communication, because the language is a common language. But we have this difficulty. And if I whispered in your ear today, now, and had you sort of pass it around, and by the time it got to you, to me, I probably wouldn't recognize it. Wouldn't even have to go clear around. Because we do not really comprehend this. Now, Nichols was very disturbed with Jones's result at Columbia. So he rounded up a bunch of herring chokers there at the University of Minnesota and said, you know, they can't be this bad. And what he did was to line up some of the best lecturers he could find. And he said, "I want you to come in and give us 10 minutes of your best, of your best." And then he asked for an exam from them that would test the students on what they thought they should have understood. And he found out essentially the same results as Joe. He found out that the average retention of these students was about 50% of what he thought they should have had 10 minutes after the lecture. And that you didn't have to wait 2 weeks, but you only had to wait 2 days to give them the same exam and find out that they're down to 25% as an average retention. Now that was a very disturbing thing to Nichols too. And you must realize that if the average retention is 25%, half of them have to be below 25%. Now, that's even worse as you contemplate the future. So I was not at all surprised at this when I read it in the 1950s and 60s. And when I was at the University of California, I'd stand before these students, the brightest and best of the California school system, because there was only, the highest 8% that got into the school where I taught. I'd stand before this group and give them brilliant lectures. I would follow them up by enlightened examinations. And then I would collect up the examinations, take them home, or go to my study and close the door, read them and weep. The reason I did that, I didn't want my wife to see a grown man cry. Because I realized what they did. That even these outstanding students, there was a lot lost in it. Now, as a result of these experiences of mine and those of Nichols and some contributions by people here within the village and many people that I have talked to about listening, between the many of us, we have put together some things we call the characteristics of bad listeners. And I would like now, for the next few minutes, to discuss some of these characteristics with you, hoping that it will be helpful to you, as it is helpful to me, and it has been helpful to me to study this. And perhaps you may even identify yourself in some of these areas, and thereby perhaps help yourself, or more importantly, help those around you. The first characteristic of a bad listener is that he or she decides that the subject is uninteresting. And you could have well done that today. You hear the subject announced, and I sometimes hesitate to even announce that the subject is unlistening. Because most people say, I got 2 ears. They're not as big as Busted's, but they're pretty big. And I've been listening all my life, and who needs it? So, and many of you are going to be trapped many times. Your wife will drag you off to something, or your husband will drag you off to something, and you're trapped. So you're going to have to sit there and go through it. And you might as well utilize the time. And as I go through here, I'll try to give you some tips on this. And in this regard, I always recall the writings of G.K. Chesterton, one of my favorite authors in England. He is now since dead. I liked G.K. Chesterton for many reasons, and I liked him because he said there's no such a thing as an uninteresting subject, just uninterested listeners. And even if you get trapped, like some lecture announced how to care for camellias in nuclear attack, maybe you'll get something out of it if you take it as a challenge. I should point out that G.K. Chesterton also, he wrote some beautiful prose, and some of the most beautiful was about pigs. And he thought pigs were beautiful, and so do I. And perhaps sometime during my stay here in the next 10 days, perhaps I'll tell you about pigs, for I've spent much of my life with them. But my family hesitates to come to the lectures that is announced as my life with the pigs. And I don't know why. To know them is to respect and enjoy and realize their great beauty as well as their utility. Well, so that's what you do. You take it as a challenge and say, maybe there's something good in it, and we'll really look for it. And sometimes you have to look pretty hard for it, but look. Another thing that the bad listener does is to wait to deliver a speech carefully rehearsed while listening. And when you're preparing this speech, you really can't be listening, or listening very carefully. Another thing that the bad listener does is to listen carefully for flaws in the presentation, so that at the first opportunity, they can clobber the speaker. We have a lot of that today, and some of the interchange is very good. And I'll have more to say about that later. But as you are doing this and concentrating on this, you cannot really comprehend what the person is saying. Another thing that the bad listener does, or a characteristic of him or her, is that they do not understand nonverbal communication. Now, I have an advantage that only one other person, probably at Holden here this week, has in this regard. And that is that I'm a veterinarian. And there is one other veterinarian camp now. There's more and more veterinarians coming to Holden because they not only have a resident nurse, a resident poet, a resident theologians, and all of these, but they also have resident veterinarians. So we're coming up in the world. But what I mean by this is that veterinarians do not have the disadvantage that their patients can lie to them. Our patients do not speak to us in a language that's common to you. We are trained to make our observations by other than a verbal communication. And so through the years, we try to develop this skill in diagnosis of where this animal is at this point in time, and we also extend it to people. In fact, I have essentially a new staff in the office in which I work. I guess some of them have only been there a few months and some up to a year and a half. And in the morning when they come in and say hi to me or whatever they say to me in the morning, sometimes it's kind of hard to say that. Sometimes it's kind of hard for them to say that in the morning. But just in a very short conversation, I can pretty much tell where they are. I know probably whether they've had a fight with their husband or they had a bad night or they're not feeling well. And so this is, to an extent, an advantage, and it's something we must train ourselves to. My wife, who's probably not here today, but she could be sitting way across that room down by that coffee pot, and she could put me down or lift me up without saying anything verbally. Or I know I'm going to catch it afterwards, but... I respect her physiology. I'm a Jerry Ford type guy in that I make my own breakfast. I really believe in this if you got a wife like the chief. To ask her, because I get up very early in the morning. This morning I woke up at 3:30, but I didn't get up. But I usually get up sometime after 5, and I have my breakfast sort of around 6, made by myself, but set out by the chief the night before, because she's a night person. But to ask her to come out and make breakfast, she just might turn on the right rear burner and put the teapot on the front left, and put raisins in my cup of Dr. Jarvis's tea. To ask her to do otherwise is to ask her something that she is incapable of at that time. This is true with a lot of people. You must respect their physiology and also respect where they are at that time. What you might say to a person this hour may get a completely different response than 4 hours from now or tomorrow. And you must respect that. And as a good listener, you must be alert to in the area of nonverbal communication. So I'm an early person. My wife is a night person. That causes other complications, but we respect one another's physiology. Now, Another characteristic of a bad listener is that they become over-concerned with facts and detail. And I'm sure some of you do like I do. You kind of like the little facts and tidbits, and so you listen to a lecture, but looking for just these little things that you can try out on your friends. They might have not heard. And in the medical literature too, and this is one of a real an issue that really raises my hackles. We in the health sciences, we were always publishing data on surveys of so much of a response positive to the utilization of, say, a certain drug. And maybe it's 7 out of 11 positive. And so we report it out as 63.634% or something. 5 significant places, when we really probably hardly know it to 1. To say that roughly 2/3 would be as close as probably the data will give it to you, but we try to make it very precise when the data isn't there for it. And we do that in our listening. We look for these little nitty things when we should be looking at structure and overall concepts, but also some very good things that have a great value to them, such as this morning. There were several really great things said by both lectures that we well should hear and remember. So I recall, and I've often recalled in this lecture, when I was at the University of Washington, when I was in graduate work there, there was a Harvard student there who was in medicine, and he had the greatest outline, course notes that I've ever seen in my life. They were the neatest things you've ever seen, and he used a ruler for indentation, and they were really neat. But he didn't really A the course, or I think he had the potential to, but he was so concerned with his outline that he got lost in it. He wasn't really hearing everything. So don't get caught up. And as I point out often at this stage, on biological numbers, and what's significant. And I think one of the most significant numbers in biology is a woman's age. And I don't care whether they're 39 or 39.2. And I don't think anybody else does either. Even the woman that's 39. Another characteristic of the bad listener is that they can't cope with periods of silence and use them effectively. Rich Kammer gave me this one, and it's so true, because, and I've tried it. Sometimes I give this lecture at about 180 to 200 words a minute. That's what I did at the Rotary Club in Seattle last Wednesday, because they gave me 33 minutes to cover a whole array of subjects. So I went along at that rate. And the same with Carol this morning. He was going along at about 180, I suppose, at least 192, sometimes 202. But you were all paying very close attention. Because if you speak very rapidly, you're afraid you're going to miss something, so you're going to pay really close attention. Sometimes I do that, and then I'll suddenly stop, and I'll fumble with my papers. Sometimes I do it because I have to fumble with my papers. But sometimes I do it intentionally, especially with quite a large audience. And then I look over my Ben Franklin glasses and kind of see what they're up to. And the audience becomes very restless. They become very concerned for various reasons. I don't know all the reasons, but some of them I think are worried maybe the old geezer had a heart attack. And so it is some compassion with this person. But the good listener, in a case like this, utilizes this time of silence to recapitulate, because there is no good way of learning outside of recapitulation, of repetition, of going over it and over it again. That's the only way you learn and retain it, is to utilize it and recapitulate. And today, when I'm going along in this presentation, and I'm going through these various characteristics, and some of them will be very... some of them you say, well, that's pretty simple, and I already know that. Well, at those moments where you already know it, you can recapitulate on those things that you didn't know, so that at the end of the lecture, and especially for you who are still in school, this is one of the best ways, and this is what I emphasize for In our beginning classes, I usually give them some of these things that will assist them in their comprehension as they enter the university, or in my case, a professional school. Although last year I gave it to all of the entering students at Washington State University. Now, so you utilize these periods then of silence to recapitulate. Another thing that the bad listener does is to fake attention. Some students, I've seen them in other situations, where they're there very much to impress the instructor and to really sit up there in the front row like a thoroughbred at the starting gate. And they're really all tensed up, and they're wasting a lot of energy being all tensed up to make an impression. And these are the kind of facades. We all wear some kind of facade, and it's very heavy merchandise to carry along. And these are the kind of facades. We all wear some kind of facade, and it's very heavy merchandise to carry along. The chief, my wife, I call her the chief, she tells a very good story in this regard. It's about the two psychiatrists, the young one and the old one. They were all both working on the 23rd floor of this medical building. And they often saw each other going up in the morning and coming back at night. And one day, after a very strenuous day for the young psychiatrist, he happened to come to the elevator the same time as the old psychiatrist. And the young psychiatrist said to the old psychiatrist, he says, "You look as fresh tonight as you did this morning. How can you go through a day like we often go through, listening to all these problems of all these people, and still look so fresh at the end of the day?" And the old psychiatrist said, "Who listens? Who listens?" Well, but he at least he at least faked he was probably listening. Another story I often tell at this point was in another psychiatrist's office at the end of a day. He was called on by a very desperate person. And he listened to his story, and it was indeed a desperate story. I won't give you the psychiatric analysis and diagnosis, but he was lower than a snake in a wagon track. And the psychiatrist, of course, was pressed for some kind of a therapeutic regimen, as many of us in the health sciences are. And we're often pressed because there's so little we know about biology and medicine. I hope that doesn't come as a shock to you. But at least we've gained a little bit from the 1900s, early 1900s, when we were doing more harm than good. Now and then we do a little good now. But this psychiatrist got an idea. And he said, "Here's what I want you to do tonight. There's a great circus in town." And he says, "There's a lot of great acts in this circus. But the one that I do not want you to miss is the clown." He says, "This clown is the greatest one I've ever seen. And don't miss him." And there was this long period of silence. And then this person, this very desperate person, said, "I am that clown." It's hard to be somebody, try to be somebody that you are not. It's a facade that is too heavy to bear for anyone. Another characteristic of a bad listener is that he or she tolerates bad performance of a lecture. And what I often relate at this point is what happened to me when I left General Electric Company and went to the University of California. And I thought, well, I'm getting in the big time now, and I got to find out how the big timers do it. And so I went around to a lot of lectures outside my field and inside my field. And I was I was impressed with some and very distressed at others. In fact, I was exceedingly distressed with some, because the students were sitting out there. They were sometimes very bad lectures. Some of it you couldn't hear, even if you were only halfway back. You couldn't see some of the stuff that was written on the blackboard, and even if you could have seen it, you couldn't understood it, because it wasn't written legibly. They had slides, presentations up there that were too small to see even halfway back, but nobody said anything. There was no criticism of it at all, and the professor just went blithely on, and the next day it would be little improvement on many of them. Well, they changed things in some lectures, at least, after I started telling them some of this. In fact, it sort of got out of hand in the early 70s. But we owe this to one another. In a way, that doesn't mean that you interrupt the preacher on Sunday morning and say, "You've said you know 12 times already and you're only halfway through the sermon." And it's bugging me. But bring this to their attention if things are bugging you. I happen to belong to the C.S. Lewis School of Philosophy that says no friend is a friend of mine if he doesn't care whether I lie, cheat, and steal. We care about that. Why are we really tough on our children sometimes? It's because we don't want them to grow up to be clods. And so we're tough on them. When I went to the University of California to assume responsibilities in a situation, that was a real challenge, or I probably wouldn't have gone. And it was a real challenge. And one of the things I diagnosed almost immediately is that they did not give one another the advantages of constructive criticism. They'd say a lot about the other person behind his back, but never any direct confrontation. And in that situation, in the field of science, you cannot carry on. You owe this to one another, but you do it in a kind way, with warm fuzzies. I spoke out of town many years ago. I was invited to this place, and I gave a talk, and it was a bummer. And I knew it, and I think most of the audience did. And they met me at the door as I went out, and all the adults said, that was really great, we're glad you came. And one kid came through there, and he said, "That was kind of a lousy talk." Well, that kind of stopped me a little bit, although I knew it. And the one lady who invited me heard him, and she says, "Oh, you must, don't pay any attention to what he says, because he's a retarded child, and all he does is repeat what other people say." So we owe this to one another, and how do we judge what we say? And we heard something about this morning at Matins. Oh, it's snuffy. You should ask yourself three questions about what you say to another person. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it necessary? And I want you always to remember that. If you don't remember anything I ever say, other than I say anything else I say today, I want you to remember that, because it's a good criteria. Now, but you must realize that something that might be true and necessary may not be very kind. In fact, I've been told some things that were necessary and true, but when I heard them, they didn't sound very kind to me. In fact, I lost a few nights of sleep. Yet, in the long run, they were some of the kindest things that happened to me. They were a short time unkind, but they were long-term kind. But in this whole attitude, and there are some people, and some we have three children, and you deal with each one differently. Some of them you sort of have to almost beat over the head, and others it doesn't go that way. And I often recall for some of my associates, and in the field of science especially, in the field of science, we teach people to be very critical, because that's the nature of the business. You are critical, and this is how you extend, you're critical of everything. The person I did one of my graduate degrees under was Tony Cunha. He's now at Florida. Now, I was young then, and doing studies in nutrition, and there were a lot of times when Tony, as a young professor, she had a really, really beat on me. Just given me holy Ned. But I can't ever recall that he ever gave me hell. But when I was doing something wrong, he'd show up and help me. And we'd go through it again, he'd come out there and help me. Now, there wasn't anything that I wouldn't do for Tony Cunha. I worked night and day for that guy. So if you pass it out with a warm fuzzy, the results are usually much better. You do not provoke your children to wrath. As my older daughter taught me well, not soon enough. But fortunately, she taught it to me. Another characteristic of a bad listener is that he or she allows emotional words to throw them. And I'm not going through a vocabulary here today, but I could go through a vocabulary or in my presentation come up with words that would be emotionally disturbing to you, and you'd be off and running. You'd be in another area. Like in a conversation, in one of the ones I use here, that there's enough Scandinavians here that will appreciate this, that if somebody says, Christopher Columbus discovered America in 1492, it just sets me off something terrible. And I I'm lost. Because I know one of my forefathers here was here 400 or 500 years before, and Columbus was just a Johnny-come-lately. So I get very emotionally aroused at this. But we got to fight this. As good listeners, you don't let those things get in your way. You still hear the person out. Another thing that the bad listener does is tune the speaker out. So we often do that, and as we're thinking, and a lot of times I go to lecture, and I'll admit I might not hear anything because of the very pressing problems that I have, and that I'm trying to resolve or come up with an answer that has to be given. And so I'm sometimes a very poor listener. Or if the sermon isn't going very well, then I write my own on what I do with the text. Now, that isn't good listening. But also, it depends a lot on your speaker, and you can utilize this time very effectively, and I do. I get a lot of my correspondence done during seminars. Because in a university situation, there's some crazy rule, there's some reason for it. You always have 50-minute classes. And so you have 50-minute seminars. And people come in sometimes with 18 minutes of good stuff, but they never speak less than 50 minutes, and usually 56 or 62. And they're going out there at the rate of about 100 words a minute. And they get up and draw an ordinate and an abscissa and draw some lines on it and forget the label or whatever they are. And they're going along at this, and maybe they got two or three pretty good ideas, if they're any good at all, during the 50 minutes. But during this time, I can probably answer about five or six letters and still answer and still ask some fairly intelligent questions at the end of the seminar, which they sometimes expect me to do. But this takes a lot of experience. And if you're not real good listeners, I wouldn't start it right away. And if you do it, be sure you sit in the back of the room, because it's very disturbing to me as a speaker to find somebody reading a book in the first row. And I wondered about this. I remember when I was teaching University of California, and in this particular area, I thought I was pretty good, and I thought the lectures were very well prepared, and I usually got good response for it. In this particular class, it was just like zombies out there. Boy, I wondered if I was losing my touch, or oh boy, it's lost it, you know. And then I realized what was going on. They were having exams in the course that was taught the next hour. And they could just as well not been there. So use that very carefully. And the last one I'm going to bring to you. No, there's two more I'm going to give you. And these are both very, very important, so I've saved them for the last. One is that a bad listener questions for victory rather than clarification. And we all do it, don't we? We do it to our students. The students do it to the professors. In fact, there's more of that going on than the other right now. And the students are very bright. I know in our professional school, they're exceedingly bright. And some of them are quite a bit smarter than the professors, but they don't have the experience and the training. But they're very bright, and they can do this. They can be one-upmanship in good form. And we get pretty good at the put-down. We do it to our children. And husbands and wives do it to one another. I know of a case where they've gone through several years of hell. They were about to split the sheets, but they fortunately they went to see a counselor, the pastor. He sent them to a good counselor. The counselor was just a few minutes realizing what they were doing, and this is one of the things they were doing. They just weren't communicating. And he said, "Here's what I want you to do. For the next two or three weeks now, whenever one of you says to another anything more than pass the salt, or the other one repeats what he or she thinks the other one said." And it wasn't long before they were in hilarious laughter, because they realized they really hadn't been communicating. So don't question for victory. Question for clarification. It isn't an opportunity, or utilized as an opportunity, to put down. Another thing that the bad listener does, and this is the last one, is to criticize the speaker for ineptness and appearance. Now, I'm dressed fairly reasonably here today. But usually, and I always look at a new audience when I first come in. And most people, when they see me the first time, often they do a double take. But with me, they often look three times to be sure it's true. And they probably say to themselves, "I like to have that nose full of nickels. I wonder where he lose his chin," and a lot of things like this. Or last week I was at the Seattle Rotary, and most of these people didn't know me from a gooseberry, and I stood up there and I was wearing my listening tie. Some of you have seen this tie. You see, ties they really bug me, because you men have to admit they're a useless item. They're not good for anything, although they're colorful, and I love ties, but they're really non-utilitarian. So I had my wife make a utilitarian tie, which I'm sorry I didn't bring along. It's very wide, and it has a zipper in it. And you see, when I go out on some of these talks that I use, and I usually bring along when I give my talk on listening, You see, it's zipped open, and then I can pull out some notes out of it. And sometimes I carry cookies in it. Sometimes they don't feed me when I come there. And also, you know yourself, when you wear a tie, what are they good for? They catch gravy and soup, huh? And then you got to get them clean. That costs money. Well, you see, with a zipper, you can unzip it, fold it open, and if you're eating right, the gravy and the soup drips into it, then you just zip it up. It's one of the really great inventions. And also, you can lend it to your friends who go to cocktail parties, because you can be sure that if you're wearing that tie at a cocktail party, late in the evening, someone will come up to you, put his arm around you, and say, "Hey, buddy, the fly on your tie is half open." But when I stood before this Rotary Club, which is the biggest Rotary Club I've ever spoken to, from California to Washington, and I speak to Rotary Clubs, I've started to speak to Rotary Clubs because I found out they're the ones that run the country. And so I got to get the word to them. And but when I stood up to that podium, you can imagine, and here I am, and it was hurting my brother because he's a clothes horse, and here I show up at this thing with this big orange tie, my vest open, and you just don't, and this pretty decent blue suit. Well, that is kind of at least to a lot of people, this would be kind of a clash of colors. And at Rotary, I mean Rotarians, they keep their fly sipped up and their vests closed, you know. So this was exceedingly disturbing, I'm sure, to these Rotarians. First of all, to have somebody that looks like me stand before them. And then with this great big tie sticking out here. It reminds me of my first time that I did this at the University of California. It's a large audience like this. When they announced that I was going to speak to them about listening. And I always wore a lab coat in those days. And that was a time when that was characterized by two things we don't see now. Students in those days wore ties. They don't anymore. But they didn't wear any old tie. They wore a very narrow tie. So you can imagine this audience as I got up from my chair, walked to the podium, let my lab coat go open, and revealing this belly warmer I wore. I didn't have my zipper tie, but I had one of these wide belly warmers. That's a wide tie. And you could just, their eyeballs came out like this, and they were going like this, you know? Get a load of that, see? Or one night I spoke to a ladies' club, and they didn't have a podium, so I sat up like this. And this chair isn't so good for this, but, and I pull up my pants, and like today, I got one different color of socks than he did. But then I had a green sock and an orange one. Huh? And they were writing each other's notes. So, now what is the point of all this? Or some of you, and some of them, because I learned a different language than the one I've been trying to speak today first. And so I blame some of my rhetoric onto that. But what I point out to my audience, as I did last week, is that if somebody came running in here today and said, "Get out of this rat nest that's on fire," you wouldn't say, "Couch that in better rhetoric." You'd get out of here because you understood it. Well, the point of all this is that the bad listener loses a lot when he criticizes the speaker for ineptness, because as you're doing this, you are not listening. The only reason that you go to hear a talk is not to evaluate the appearance, the language, or anything else of the speaker. You go there for only one thing, to hear what he or she has to say, evaluate it, and pick out the things, the structure that's important, and try to recapitulate to learn what is important for you. That's the only reason. So knock off with the rest of it. So that's so much for the characteristics of a bad listener. Now I would like to just wax there's another dimension to this that I'd like to bring to your attention that is very important to me, and I hope it is to you. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer has said it so well he was mentioned this morning. Carol mentioned him because he's one of the patron saints. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, the first service that one owes to others in the fellowship consists in listening to them. And that's so very important that it is in God's love for us that he not only gives us his word, but also lends to us his ear. So it is his work that we do for our brother and our sister when we learn to listen to them. And so many times, we who are professors and pastors, we're always feeling a lecture coming on. And we feel that they're out there to listen and we're here to speak. Where in reality, probably our greatest service is to listen. I know in my own case, some people have come to me after many years and say, you know, Leo, you really helped me out that time. And I'll think, now, what great counsel did I give that person? What sage advice did I give them? And as I think about it, I realize that I had not given them any sage advice at all, but I had listened to them. And we're in our dealings too with God. We always say, "Hear, Lord, thy servant speaketh," much more often than we say, "Speak, Lord, thy servant heareth." Now, we can hear the words of John Godfrey, who wanted to be something other than a lawyer. His parents were immigrants, so they knew that lawyers run the country, and they wanted John to help run the country, so they said, "You be a lawyer." So they sent him off to law school. They gave him a mediocre lawyer, moved into this town. The town grew around him. And during too many years, of course, he'd listened to a lot of people, and he had good experiences in this town, kindly old fellow that he was. And because he had accumulated a good deal of property, which became very valuable, he became quite wealthy. And he thought at the age of 70 or 80 that he would do something for this town. So he engaged the best architect he could find to build a most remarkable structure. And of course, a lot of people were wondering what the old governor was up to. But he wouldn't tell them. Until the day of dedication, when they noticed that a sign had gone up over the front of this building, and it said, "The Man Who Listens." And then, by way of dedication, John Godfrey gently explained, "One of the most terrible aspects of this world today is that nobody listens to anyone else. If you're sick or even dying, nobody listens. If you're bewildered or frightened or lost or bereaved or alone or lonely, nobody really listens. Even the clergy are hurried and harassed. They do their work, they do their best and work endlessly, but time has taken on a fragmented character. It doesn't seem to have any substance any longer. Nobody has time to listen to anyone, not even those who love you and would die for you. Your parents, your children, your friends. They have no time. That's a very terrible thing, isn't it? But whose fault is it? I don't know, but there just doesn't seem to be any time." Now, these are really the words of Taylor Caldwell in her fiction, The Listener. But you really don't have to go to fiction to hear these words. But as important as it is to listen to people, and it's all important, it is even more important first to listen to God. God has had a lot of trouble with this, and his prophets too, as I recalled for you early, shouted, "You have ears, but you do not hear." I think there are about 1,200 references to listening and hearing in the Bible. From that I would glean that it was a very important subject. Where do you hear God? I turn to the writings, as I often do, the writings of L. Rodness in this regard, who is in your midst and will be speaking to you who are new later, and to all of you later. You hear him everywhere, or you hear him nowhere. To hear him, you must hear him in Jesus Christ. First, it's a local voice before it becomes a universal one. You hear him in one place before you hear him in every place. God remains a vague mystery and a hidden power, and therefore not the great God of creation until you have him in the person of someone who walked among us. The roar of the cascading stream remains just a roar,
The rustle of the wind in the trees remains just a rustle. Nature speaks only her own language unless you hear God speak to you through Jesus Christ. Happy is the man, the woman, the child who has tuned his ear to the living word and opens up to the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Then everything begins to speak of God. Knowing his love, you know his majesty. Know his love, you can see his handiwork in the intricate and complex designs of all creation. But there's a risk in listening to him, for then you risk hearing other voices, the groans, the cries of the unfortunate of the world, people with problems even as close as your own home and the one next door. Now there are many stories and statements that you can listen to that are undisturbing. They leave you in peace. H2O is water, trees are green, and skies are blue. Now when I hear this, my life remains unchanged. But there are other things that we hear that are most disturbing. Now yesterday, we ordained two remarkable couples. And I suppose it was the same with these couples as it was with me. In the case of Johan and Sonia, it wasn't long ago since they were married, and it wasn't so long ago that they met one another. And I'm sure it was happened on some evening, perhaps it was in our case. It was a lovely day, and when the chief said, "I love you and I want to marry you." Now Sonia probably said that to Johan. Now when Johan heard this, he didn't just say, "Here we go again," you know, or "Boy, I can't talk to you now. I got to go and play volleyball." That called for a decision. He either had to reject Sonia or give his heart to her. Or vice versa. It had to be vice versa. Now God's call is like that to us. The old story of Jesus and his love is like that. We can't listen to the story that Jesus bar Joseph, the carpenter of Nazareth, was in fact and in truth, in a very literal sense of the word, the God by whom all things were made. He was not merely a man so good as to be like God. He was God. We cannot face the cross where Christ died to forgive our sins so that we might obtain sonship. We cannot hear this story and do nothing. We must either escape the tormenting reach of the story by rejecting him, or be caught up in the wonderment of it all, in the sheer wonder of his love. He that hath ears to hear, let him hear.